I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Monday night's presidential debate beat out Monday Night Football, with more than 80 million people tuning in to watch Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump duke it out for the presidency. In fact, broadcast and cable news promoted it like a Super Bowl matchup, with pounding music and voice of God narration. While Trump and Clinton were the main event, they shared the stage with moderator Lester Holt, anchor of NBC News. Now, there was a lot of hype and speculation about how much and whether he would fact-check the candidates, how much he would insert himself into the back and forth. We'll talk about his role and the role and responsibility of the press in this unusual campaign season. And we have three guests who have joined us. Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist, senior writer for The American Prospect, also writes for the Plum Line blog that's at The Washington Post and for The Week. He's also the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. Paul Waldman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Norman Ornstein is with us as well, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He's also co-author of the book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Norm Ornstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be with you.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Brendan Nyhan, professor at Dartmouth College, also a contributor to the New York Times Upshot blog. And Brendan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Brendan, let me begin with you, and let's begin with Lester Holt. How do you think he did on Monday night?
I thought he did fine. It's an extremely hard job to balance the responsibility of a moderator to let the candidates have some back and forth, to have exchanges and let the public see them go back and forth, while at the same time calling out the most important evasions of a question or the most important cases in which a candidate is making a claim that isn't true. Is it perfect? Was it perfect? Did I agree with every choice he made? No, but it's a very difficult job. I think people worried after the Matt Lauer interview with Donald Trump in particular at a candidate forum that was held within the last few weeks, that the moderators would be too soft and too unwilling to follow up with candidates when they made claims that weren't supported by the facts. And I think I'd say in general, people were pleasantly surprised that Holt seemed to follow up aggressively in a few important cases.
Norma, what's your analysis? And I have to say, for the first 20, 30 minutes or so of the debate, I forgot Lester Holt was there. Maybe that was a good thing in letting the candidates go back and forth.
Yeah, I agree. I think he did what he should have done when it came to fact-checking, which is not to challenge a statement made by a candidate directly, but to make assertions that are factually true. And then when the candidate, Trump in this case, denied them or said something that was a lie or false, to call him on it. The one area where I think he could have done a little bit better was to be more aggressive when it came to the time checks. He let the candidates go on, and he especially let Trump go on and on and on, way after his time limits, the ones that they'd all agreed to, had come and gone, and maybe a little bit more of that. But otherwise, in an extraordinarily difficult role, especially following Matt Lauer, who was such a disaster from his own network, you've got to give Holt some real credit.
How about from you, Paul?
Yeah, well, I agree with everything that Brendan and Norm have said. It's difficult because if you just get mired in the fact-checking, then that can be all the debate ends up being, and you spend the entire time just kind of going back and forth, especially when you're dealing with a candidate like Trump in particular, who has kind of upended a lot of the norms around fact-checking that we have, including the idea that if an objective observer says, you got this wrong, that the candidate is going to stop saying it. So, you know, he could have spent his entire time arguing with Trump about the facts that he was getting wrong. So it's a difficult position. You want to do just enough of it to try to keep them honest, but not so much that that ends up being all that you end up talking about. So I think Holt did about as good a job as we could have expected.
I was looking at a list of who got the more questions, who spent more time talking. The thing that really jumped out at me, Paul, was the number of interruptions, that Donald Trump interrupted Hillary Clinton a lot more than she did for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he has a particular style that we saw in the primary debates, where it's obviously very important for him to kind of be dominant, to be the one who is controlling the conversation, to show his almost physical superiority. You know, a lot of the insults that he throws at his opponents, that was true in the primaries and it's true of Clinton too, are about how he's physically superior. He's bigger than they are. They're weak. They're they don't have stamina. He said that over and over again about Clinton. One of the things that especially I think there's a lot of research about this, about this, particularly the way men and women relate to each other in conversation, it's often that men show their dominance by interrupting people. It's a way of saying, I'm in control and I can decide when you get to talk or not. Women are much less likely to interrupt because that's sort of a display of dominance that they're often less willing to do. And Trump certainly does it a lot. He does it with everybody to show that he's the one who's in charge.
Well, let me play a clip. And this is Hillary Clinton talking during Monday night's debate, discussing Trump's views on the invasion of Iraq. And let's give it a listen.
Well, I hope the fact checkers are turning up the volume and really working hard. Donald supported the invasion of Iraq.
Wrong.
That is absolutely
wrong.
Proved over and over again.
Wrong.
He actually advocated for the actions we took in Libya.
To you, Brendan, I think that's just a good example of what we were just talking about. And this is something that has dogged Donald Trump for some time now. We've gotten people now quoting Howard Stern to prove him right or prove him wrong, I guess. What do you make of that? And here's Hillary Clinton saying, let's bring on the fact checkers.
It's at least a signal of how important fact checkers have become, that they're repeatedly being referenced in the course of the debate. So it's at least cueing the public that if you'd like to see the documentary evidence in this case, it's available to you, right? Lesser Holt is not going to bring out a timeline of everything Donald Trump said before the war. But in this case, Hillary Clinton is correct. Donald Trump did publicly express support for the war. There's no record of him expressing clear opposition to the war prior to the U.S. invasion. Now, what's difficult about it is what Paul just mentioned. Trump's behavior shatters previous norms. He's unwilling to back down. He denies things that are on the record and does it over and over and over again. It puts Holt in a very difficult position. Does Holt have to try to live fact check every one of these claims? Right. So Trump is denying things that he has said or written repeatedly during the course of the debate, and Trump, Holt may not have those at his fingertips, of course, and it throws people off. It undermines the possibility of having a normal conversation. A normal political debate, a candidate would say, well, I didn't mean it that way, or I've changed my mind, or there'd be some sort of a discussion. But in this case, the entire premise for the conversation is undermined. It's very confusing, and it's very hard to have a normal political conversation under those circumstances.
So what's the challenge then for the press, Norm Ornstein, to deal with that? And you look at all the fact-checking organizations, Trump completely sort of out lies, if I can say, Hillary Clinton when it comes to some of this fact-checking. And yet here he is, of course, the nominee for the Republican Party for the presidency.
We've never had a liar like Donald Trump, and we see this over and over again with every independent group. And I do think, you hate to do pop psychoanalysis, but I think Trump actually believes what he says when he says it, which is a mark of sociopathy, and it's an enormous challenge for the press. I did a back and forth with Chris Saliza of the Washington Post that he very gallantly put up on their website.
In fact, I'm holding it in my hand here, Norm. Now, go ahead.
But also, Jay Rosen of NYU, who's a very astute student of journalism, has written a terrific piece about how this campaign has fried the brains of journalists, because there's just an assumption going in that you're dealing with a major party presidential nominee who's going to fit within the norms of behavior of those nominees. And when you have one who doesn't, it becomes extraordinarily difficult. It's not just a challenge in debates. It's a challenge in the overall coverage. It's this notion that you have to be equivalent in the kind of coverage. You have to be balanced. But when something is unbalanced, if you're balanced, there's something wrong about it. And I think we're starting to see now an adjustment made by the press, because Trump has been Trump for long enough that it's becoming clear. And it's becoming clear that if you cover him in the same traditional way, that you're going to look like idiots along the way. I would say, just in addition, if you go back and read Trump's books or look at the interview that he did many years ago in Playboy, or even what he said, deep in his DNA almost is this notion that you cannot show weakness, and if somebody challenges you or attacks you, you have to come back and hit them harder, and you can't leave it alone, you can't let it go. And that was displayed in this debate, and it's clear it was a disaster for him. Whether he can adjust to it in the second debate on October 9th is going to be the most interesting element of this, because I have no doubt that Hillary Clinton is going to use the same kinds of red flags to get him to erupt. And from what we've seen, especially with the Miss Universe debacle for him, is he can't let it go.
Well, let me pick up on something, and Paul, let me toss it to you, something that Norm was just saying, and I've noticed this as well. The New York Times now uses the word lie, where before you might see misrepresent or exaggerate. Do you see the mainstream media perhaps moving closer to using this word lie when it comes to Trump?
They are, but there's a lot of soul searching going on right now among the press, and nobody is completely sure exactly how to handle it, because Trump is so different, and he has done things that that no other candidate has presented them with before. Things like this sort of direct, hostile way that he talks about the press, where if you've seen his rallies, he will often point to the reporters and say, look at those people. They are the worst people ever. They're so dishonest. At which point, all of his fans turn around and begin hurling abuse at the reporters who are there. You know, other candidates have said they got unfair coverage, but nobody's ever done that before. And nobody's been as kind of blatant and repeated in the way that they repeat dishonest things that have already been checked. And so there's been a lot of kind of discussion and wondering amongst reporters and editors about how do we handle this? What do we do when he says things that are absolutely provably false? We've pointed this out, and he keeps saying them. And one of the things that they have decided to do in some instances is to say, okay, we're going to use words that we have been very reluctant to use in the past. So we're not just going to call something, you know, at odds with the facts or possibly misleading. In certain cases, we'll actually say, this is a lie. And I think that's probably good, as long as you're using it selectively, only at those times when you know that you are absolutely 100% right on the facts.
And it's
But I don't think the reporters and editors have yet really resolved this to their own satisfaction about how they handle this and what it's going to mean for their coverage in future campaigns.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Paul Waldman. He's a weekly columnist, senior writer for the American Prospect. Also with us is Norm Ornstein, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, also a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And Brendan Nyhan, professor at Dartmouth College, also a contributor to the New York Times Upshot blog. And we are talking about the press coverage of the presidential race, spending some time talking about what happened Monday night, and obviously much to talk about as the race races to the finish line in November. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about the press coverage of the presidential race. Brendan, let me read a comment from Jim, who says they are just, this is talking about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, they are just two liars lying to each other. Look how far lying and cheating has brought both of them. No reason to ever change. Just because Hillary Clinton lies slightly less than Donald Trump isn't going to win her any virtue points. What is the use of fact-checking either of them? What is the use of doing that?
Well, that's a question a lot of people are asking right now. Trump has created a kind of crisis of confidence about fact-checking. In the past, candidates have, as we've talked about, turned away from statements that have been challenged by objective observers. We're seeing him double down on those claims repeatedly now. But that doesn't mean we should give up. It doesn't mean we shouldn't fact check the candidates. And it doesn't mean we should simply throw up our hands and say, well, they both lie sometimes, therefore they lie to the same extent, right? I don't even like the word lie. I think we should focus on the accuracy of the statements made by the candidates. And when we provide information about that accuracy, we do two things. One is we do help some people make up their minds. We're not going to change everyone's minds. There's often unrealistic expectations about the effects of fact-checking. But we can help voters to become hopefully better informed. And maybe more importantly, we can help dissuade politicians from making more inaccurate claims in the future. As we've talked about, Trump is shattering norms of candidate behavior. It's important to hold him accountable, or the next candidate and the candidate after that will take the kinds of behaviors he's been displaying as the new normal. And that's a very troubling precedent. We need instead to hold elites accountable and say it is news. It should be news when someone who's a candidate for president of the United States says something that's unsupported by the facts and says it over and over again. And the fact that we've become – our senses have been dulled to that over the course of this campaign should be deeply troubling to all of us. That is always important news. That is always something that's critical from a small d Democratic perspective.
Norm, let me put to you a question about whether you think Donald Trump has both or either intimidated the press or played the press.
I think both. Let me step back for a second, though, and I think there's a larger point to make here about the notion of lies and facts. We used to have a political system where you could have debate and deliberation over very different philosophies or viewpoints about policy, but based on a common set of facts, realities. And now we have lots of people who have their own sets of facts, and that's partly a consequence of tribal media. But, you know, we do have a reality now that a majority of self-identified Republicans and conservatives still believe Barack Obama was not born in the United States, substantial numbers who believe he's a Muslim. We have a lot of people who have very different facts when it comes to issues like climate change. And if you can't start with facts, then you're going to have an inability to resolve very important policy issues and differences. And that's, I think, a larger problem. And, of course, this attack on both candidates is another element of false equivalence, trying to drag them down into the same category when they don't belong there. I think Trump and the people around him have played the press masterfully, and they have been intimidated. They're intimidated in part because reporters, journalists more generally, the thing that they hate the most is being accused of bias, and especially liberal bias. And so all of those attacks have them bending over backwards. At the same time, there's especially on cable television, there's this notion that you're going to have your dominant coverage done by the spinners from both sides. And when you have a CNN paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to hire a Corey Lewandowski, who's on air a lot and who at the same time is being paid $500,000 by the Trump campaign, when you have a Kellyanne Conway coming on and basically dissembling on a regular basis, and you have coverage that's dominated by the spinners from both sides, it once again creates a climate where voters come to believe that there are no such things as facts, and that's bad.
Let me play a clip, and there's a much longer and more complicated clip. This goes back to Monday night. It's a portion of Donald Trump's response to this whole birtherism question. Lester Holt asked him about it. This is only 9 seconds, but I think it gives us something to talk about here. Let's give it a listen.
I think I did a great job and a great service, not only for the country, but even for the president, in getting him to produce his birth certificate.
Secretary Clinton.
Paul, let me turn to you. And to me, this is this Alice in Wonderland argument. Here's Donald Trump, who for 5 years, you know, promoted this idea that Barack Obama was not an American, was born in another country, in Kenya. He even said he sent investigators to Hawaii to track down this whole birth certificate. And now he takes credit for putting this whole controversy to rest. What do you make of that? And how does the press deal with that? No, go ahead.
This is one of the things I think that
for a lot of people in the media was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. That was when many of them decided, okay, we're going to use the word lie, partly because he manipulated them in the actual event when he made that announcement. And he was finally willing to admit that President Obama is an American. They all went to his hotel in Washington, D.C. He said he was going to make this announcement. And then they spent 20 minutes filming a bunch of his supporters talking about how great he was before he finally came out and made this very brief statement telling a bunch of falsehoods. You know, he said that Hillary Clinton started the birther controversy, which is false, and he said that he finished it, which is also false, and then he walked off the stage. And I think a lot of people in the media at that point were like, you know, they basically just said, come on, enough is enough. And that's when you saw the word lie show up in headlines. But I think that his calculation is probably an accurate one, which is that you can say almost anything, and especially in a partisan context like this, your supporters will pretty much line up with your representation of reality no matter what it is. And so once he comes out and says that Hillary Clinton started the birther controversy, what happens? Well, immediately you have a bunch of Republicans who troop to the television studios and back him up on this. Now, they know that that's completely bogus, but, you know, we're in a partisan context, and so they're going to, you know, stand behind the guy who's leading their team. And so you have all this reinforcement then, and then Republican voters who are watching, they see all the people that they admire and respect who are telling them, yes, Hillary Clinton started the birther controversy, and so they come to accept that too, and then you've created an entire alternate reality where half the public believes that what you're saying is true, even if it is blatantly provably false.
But I mean, Brennan, it seems that this issue is a challenge then for fact checkers if half the population, or I think it's 20% of the population, believes that President Obama is not an American.
Oh, it's a very difficult challenge. I mean, what Paul's describing is accurate. People take their cues from elites they trust about what's true. And the political system has done a terrible job of giving people accurate cues. Lots of issues have been treated in a he said, she said manner that didn't clarify what the evidence really says. And unfortunately, once these myths get out there, like the birther myth, they're very hard to debunk. There's a kind of tribalism to people's beliefs. I just wrote in the Upshot about a poll conducted by Morning Consult, which found that a substantial fraction of Americans either still think President Obama was not born in the United States or say they don't know, mm-hmm. right? Even after Donald Trump himself repudiated that claim. So it's dangerous, and it's especially dangerous because once Donald Trump is the nominee, these issues become a matter of Republicans versus Democrats, right? Liberals versus conservatives. And when the lines are that stark and people are dividing according to their political beliefs, it's going to be very difficult to convince people of the evidence on these issues. That's the most challenging context. So the failure of the Republican primary process looms large here. It created the conditions where Donald Trump could demand and expect loyalty from the overwhelming majority of Republican voters. And unfortunately, they'll follow him often, even on dubious factual claims like this one.
I mean, Brendan, is there something that also happens that if something that's either a lie or wrong gets repeated over and over again, that more people are going to believe it just because they keep hearing about it?
That's right. There's research to suggest that this is true. There's this illusion of truth effect that may happen. If you've heard something enough times, you may take that as a cue. There's something going on, right? And in fact, Trump uses that sort of language himself, right? There's something going on, right? And so people have this inference, well, I've heard about this a bunch of times. If people wouldn't be talking about it if there wasn't something to it, maybe there really are questions about where President Obama was born. I've heard that a lot of times. So even people who aren't necessarily motivated to believe in a particular claim, if we keep making it public and raising questions and doubts about it, eventually, you know, people may say, well, maybe there is a question here. When in fact, again, important to be clear, the evidence is absolutely incontrovertible and overwhelming that President Obama was born in this country.
And that's Brendan Nyhan. He's a professor at Dartmouth College. Also with us, Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Paul Waldman, a weekly columnist, senior writer for the American Prospect. And we're talking about the press, the role, the responsibility of the press this election season, and some of the challenges it faces as it covers some of the candidates and the issues. Specifically, we've been talking about about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And we've got just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We've got a lot of comments here as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Frank from Chester Springs to join us. And Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I just have a very basic question I kept asking myself while watching this debate, which was that when any candidate, in this case we know what I'm talking about, continually interrupts, continually goes way past the time assigned to answer a question, wanders way off the topic, why does the moderator not have the ability to simply shut off his mic? Is it because no one would ever agree to that kind of restriction? Or I just wonder.
Sure.
And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Frank. Thanks for calling in. Norm, can I toss that to you?
Sure. I'd be reluctant to see that happen, just because then you really do inject the moderator more into the into the debate and the campaign. And one part of this, I do think that the interruptions tell us a lot about the candidate, and probably will have a lot to do with consolidating opposition to him from a lot of women. So, you know, for the moderator to jump in, I would have liked to have seen him done a little bit more when it came to the time allocations. But to cut off the mic and the sound, unless there is a much more egregious violation, I'd be reluctant to see that happen.
Paul, it's interesting that Donald Trump is saying that there was some problem with his mic, that Lester Holt was unfair to him, asked him unfair numbers of, I guess, hard questions compared to Hillary Clinton. What do you make of that?
Well, this is, I think, part of sort of his makeup is that I think because so many people looked at the debate afterward and said that Clinton did much better, you know, Trump needs to have an explanation for why he was actually the winner. And, you know, this again goes something that, you know, we talked about his sort of personal psychology. You can see this in some of the books that he wrote. Defining himself as the one who is dominant and the one who is winning is very, very important to him. And so after the debate, if a lot of people are saying that he lost, he has to come up with an explanation for why it was unfair. It was rigged. There was some sort of conspiracy against him. And if it had been fair, then he would have won. And you could see this even in the debate, too, and in ways that I think Hillary Clinton successfully baited him with talk about his taxes and things. You know, when she mentions that when she accuses him of not paying taxes, instead of trying to defend himself, he says, well, you know, I'm being smart. He always has to kind of convince everyone that he's the one who's on top, he's the one who's dominant, he wins in everything, he never makes a mistake. And so I think it's natural after a debate that everyone seems to be saying that he lost, that he has to come up with an explanation for why, if that's true, then it wasn't fair, just as he has told his supporters that, you know, if Hillary Clinton wins, that can only mean that the election must have been rigged.
But do you think he's saying, Paul, that it's smart, if it's smart for him not to pay taxes, that it's dumb for us to pay our taxes?
Well, you know, I really do think that's how he thinks, that, you know, everything is a test of whether he's the sucker or you're the sucker. And you can really see that in the way that he talks about business, the way he talks about negotiations. And, you know, I think Norm mentioned before about this idea that he always has to hit back whenever somebody attacks him. There's a fascinating passage in one of his books where he talks about this, about how every time somebody criticizes you, you have to come back and hit them twice as hard. And he literally says, if you don't, everyone will think you're a sucker. And there is obviously nothing that is more important to Donald Trump than making sure that everyone knows that he is not a sucker. And so I think that is something that he obviously feels deeply, even when it is incredibly politically damaging to him. I mean, we saw this yesterday after Hillary Clinton brought up the case of this woman, Alicia Machado, who was a Miss Universe. You know, it's obviously very dangerous for him to get into a fight with her. He already went through this with the Khan family. And what does he do? The next morning, he calls up Fox and Friends and starts talking about how this woman is fat. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that he can think that that is politically helpful to him, but he just cannot let it go. somebody criticized him, and he has to hit them back twice as hard. That is just who he is.
Norm, I'm holding that piece that Chris Eliza wrote in the Washington Post, this interesting debate conversation that you had with Chris Eliza about the press coverage. I just want to quote a couple of sentences here. This is you. You say, I think the coverage of Clinton has been stupid, an obsessive focus on press conferences, on the Clinton Foundation, on emails, the latter legitimate stories, but way overdone, almost nothing about our major policy proposals. Then you say that you really believe that Donald Trump has not been treated as a serious candidate or held to any kind of serious standard or standards. Based on what we just have been talking about for the last 40 minutes, what should the press then do?
Well, and here, you know, one of the areas, and I'm still seeing this now, David Farenthold of The Post, who I think has been the superstar of coverage of this campaign, who has just done dogged coverage of Trump's charitable contributions and foundation, and found acts of illegality, and in part because of, I suspect, professional jealousy and the fact that news outlets don't like to showcase the work done by a rival. We just haven't seen those issues followed up by the other journalistic outlets. A lot of the coverage of Trump has been about tactics and about how he's pivoted, or if he's going to pivot. And some of that is, getting back to the original point, you just assume that a major party presidential candidate is going to behave like a major party presidential candidate, try to broaden his appeal rather than narrow his appeal. So he's using a teleprompter. Oh, now he's becoming like a real candidate. Instead of focusing on either policy proposals, and I understand that if you're a horse race journalist or a political journalist, that's not so much what you're going to do, but delving more deeply into his background and what we know about him and what that would mean as a commander-in-chief or as a president, the kinds of people he has around him and what that would tell us, the things that would inform us more about how somebody would be as a president. And in the same way, it's absolutely the case that emails, the credibility surrounding them, the other kinds of issues that the Clinton Foundation, those are important.
Sure.
But to imagine that that's the entire arc of Hillary Clinton and her career and her background is, as I said, stupid.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about how the press has been covering the election this year. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest, Brendan Nyhan, professor at Dartmouth College, also a contributor to the New York Times Upshot blog. Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor at The Atlantic, co-author of the book It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. And Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist, senior writer for The American Prospect. His book is Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have Dan from Center City, Philadelphia. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty.
Hi there.
I think there was something he said during the primaries that was interesting, where he was talking about how he loved uneducated voters. I love the uneducated. And let's face it, in a cult of personality, everything he says is gospel to them. So, you know, that's why he's got to be fact-checked, and that's why he's got to be called a liar.
Brendan, anything you want to say in response to Dan there?
Well,
he did say that.
He did say that. Well, in fact, you know, I think that's an example of more of a politician putting their foot in their mouth than anything. I mean, Trump's appeal has been disproportionate among Americans without a college degree, right, who I wouldn't call uneducated, but maybe ones who have a college degree are more educated, right? And then he's done less well with that group. So there's a demographic divide there that's being reflected in candidate support. And, you know, that's one of the factors that you have to think about with this campaign. You know, it breaks down pretty clearly along party lines in the way that you'd expect. But Trump does better with non-college whites and worse with college whites than Romney did, for instance. And he's been doing a little worse with women and a little better with men. And those have largely offset. And so he's about where Romney was at this point in 2012. But there are some differences there that, you know, change the political landscape a little bit from 2012.
Dan, thanks for the call. Let's see.
You know, if I could jump in, Marty.
Yes, go ahead.
There's some research that shows that when it comes to accepting things that aren't necessarily true about the world, for instance, we see often that when there's a Democrat in the White House, Republicans are much more likely to say the economy is doing poorly, even if it's doing better than Democrats are, and that flips when there's a Republican in the White House. And oftentimes, it's the more educated, more informed people who are more likely to believe those false things. Hmm. And the reason is that they're getting the messages much more clearly if they're paying a lot of attention from their elites, as we talked about before, getting those cues. And so it's oftentimes the people who pay a lot more of attention to public affairs who are the ones who are the most likely to say something false about the real world, whether it's about the state of the economy, you know, whether unemployment is up or down, things like that. It's those people who more closely line up with a kind of a picture of the world as they would like it to be through their partisan lens. So it isn't always about whether you're smarter or dumber or more educated or less educated.
Thanks for the call. And Dan, let me get Jason from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jason. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. One of the commentators mentioned just the use of misinformation. And I just feel like it's actually a kind of basic public relations kind of tool. And I remember reading a book a while back called Fox Blood, Just Good for You, back early 2000s. But just the idea of spin, I mean, I haven't heard the word really spin. Everybody uses pivot these days. And, but it seems like just an old technique, and it's really, you don't even have to refute something. You just have to put out enough information to cause a sense of doubt. But I just
sure.
wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, I mean, Norm, there's nothing new about spin, is there, when it comes to American politics or certainly running for office?
No, there's definitely nothing new about spin, and it goes back to the beginnings of the Republic. But one thing I do think is different now, and it's partly because of 24-hour cable news and the need to fill that time, and that means panels of people, you know, taken to the sort of embarrassing extreme of 9 people on CNN at any given time. But what's happened is that campaign managers and campaign spokespeople have become dominant figures, and their role is to offer nothing that's honest, but just bald-faced spin. And I think that becomes destructive. And, you know, it's either the campaign managers or it's these surrogates, some of them paid, some of them not, who won't engage in anything other than sophistry. And, you know, there's a notion in journalism, we see this in part on op-ed pages, but mostly on television, that this is like the law, that you have advocates for both sides and the public is a jury and they can discern the truth. And when it comes to the world of politics, it doesn't work that way. What you get is a belief that there's nothing out there except the extremes in politics and people who are cynically spinning, and nothing is really true anymore.
Brendan, I remember when you had Spin Sanity. This was back a couple of election cycles, but it does sometimes feel as if it's spin versus fact checking.
Yeah, no, and I agree that we shouldn't, you know, so let me just say a couple things. First, spin is inherent to politics, right? So when Democrats and Republicans talk about the state of the economy, right, the Democrats emphasize the parts that are good because they control the White House, and the Republicans emphasize the parts that are bad. And that's normal. That's how politics works. That kind of spin, I think, is fine. The problem is when first we institutionalize the dumbest kinds of spin, like these ridiculous CNN panels that Norm mentioned, that are just literally people parroting talking points back and forth, which are pointless, brain dead exercises at best. And then on the other hand, when we use, I want to avoid the distinction between I want to avoid missing the distinction between spin and untruth, spin and things that are false. Right? So sometimes we say, well, there's lots of spin out there. But that's always been true of politics, right? And that can cause us to miss the genuinely different kind of tactics that Trump is using in this campaign. We have to be able to distinguish that from the normal spin that any political candidate or campaign engages in. That's a critical distinction.
Let me read a couple of comments here. We have an email from Mark. He says, fact checks could be scrolled across the screen. I want a buzzer like a quiz show. An email from Nick. Are there any reports to indicate that Trump's inaccurate statements might perhaps in part be blamed on forgetfulness rather than outright lies? An email from Paul. It's all distraction. They haven't got a way to solve the inner city problems, the ISIL problems, etc. So we got a lot of comments there. Jason, thanks for the call. Let me see what Frank from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
A couple things. I was really glad to see that Hillary Clinton finally owned up to the mistake about the emails, and it wasn't anything nefarious or subversive on her part. It was just clumsy handling of emails. And when she gets a little more honest, it helps her tremendously. And the other thing she needs to do is stay on point about what she's going to do when she becomes president versus attacking Donald Trump.
Well, Frank, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Paul, I mean, she has admitted several times that obviously this email server was a mistake for probably a whole host of reasons. Norm Ornstein talked about this sort of obsessive focus of the press on the email server. Do you think it's been overly done or the right amount of press? What do you think?
Well, I think in some ways, I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate issue, certainly. There has been a kind of lack of equivalence in the way that some of these issues are covered. It's not that the press hasn't been critical of Trump, because they most certainly have. But oftentimes with some of these issues like this, when something new comes out about Clinton's emails, what you see is that news organizations kind of flood the zone. They send a whole bunch of reporters to investigate every aspect of it. They figure out exactly what happened. They often portray it in ways that make it seem more sinister than it really is. But one of the things about it is that it sticks in the news. The story goes on for days or weeks, and then it keeps getting mentioned over and over and over. And so you then find a lot of people who will say, I don't trust Hillary because of this email thing. They can't tell you exactly what it was all about, but they know there was something nefarious there. And what we find, in contrast with a lot of the stories about Trump, of which there are so many, is that you'll have a reporter like David Farenthol from The Post, whom Norm mentioned, who is investigating something about something like Trump's foundation, but he may be the only one who's doing it. And then The Post will publish a story or two about it. It may even be on the front page, but you won't find 100 reporters behind him trying to get more stories and advance it and figure out more things. And so it doesn't have that same kind of persistence that keeps it in the news and stays in the public's mind. And that's a kind of a lack of equivalence that I think has emerged in this campaign.
We actually had him as a guest on the show a couple of weeks ago, but picking up on that, to you, Norm, then, so why if you compare the focus on the Trump Foundation versus the Clinton Foundation, what explains, you think, the disparity in coverage?
Well, and so here, and I think it's important to emphasize as well, it's not just whether the focus is negative or positive. It's the placement of stories. What makes the front page? What makes the front page above the fold? What gets a page or two and a lot of column inches inside? What's the lead story when the news comes up? What's the first thing that's talked about by the guests? And there we see just an enormous number of front page above the fold stories on emails and the Clinton Foundation, almost all of which have the conclusion questions have been raised, and one-off stories on Trump. The New York Times did some terrific investigative reporting early on about Trump, including the fact that he cut off the medical funding for his grandnephew who has cerebral palsy because he wanted to get back at the family, his own family. And that was once, and it was gone. And I think, you know, Farenthol has just done terrific stuff. But as I said earlier, once somebody else is on that story, others don't want to get into it because they're going to have to give him a lot of credit. And so other outlets stay away from it. And I think that's been a real failing this time around. It's not just what gets covered. It's whether it gets covered once or whether there's a lot of digging and what gets on the front page.
I was reading, Brendan, your tweets during the, or I guess it was actually after the Monday night debate, and one of the suggestions I guess you had was just watch, don't tweet, that there can be a kind of groupthink that happens when people are tweeting about an event. Can you expand on that for us? As you were tweeting about it, of course. Do we have Brendan there? We seem to have lost Brendan. Okay, well, we'll try to get him back. Let me get, looks like Sally to join our conversation. And Sally, go ahead. You're on the air. Nope. Don't you just love live radio? Well, let me.
The microphone problem that Trump had. There's got to be a conspiracy here somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, actually, Norm, since I heard your voice, let me ask you, and you talk about, and I actually have, you know, the cable TV big screen on in my studio here, so I can look at it out of the corner of my eye. What do you think of things like body language experts or, you know, focus groups with undecided voters? You mentioned the surrogates. A lot of that is to fill time, obviously, but what purpose do you think it serves, if any?
It's infotainment, and that's pretty much all it is. But, you know, one of the problems that emerges from all of that is that, once again, we fail to distinguish between things that are real and important to look at and those that are not. And so when you get these focus groups, which have little scientific validity, but they can often make good television, if you equate that with a reasonably good survey, you're making a mistake. And then what we also get is this huge volume of surveys, some of which are completely fly-by-night or really badly designed, and they all get conflated together. And, you know, the notion language experts can tell us something that is meaningful or insightful, I find, is a stretch.
Do we have you back, Brendan? No, we don't seem to have him. Okay, let me get...
Go ahead, Paul. One of the interesting things I think about this is that so much of the news coverage of the campaign is about how people are going to interpret what's happening in the campaign. Not so much what's actually happening, but this discussion about, you know, is it going to play with this group of voters? How is his his body language going to come off to the undecideds? The assumption underneath all of that is if you're watching, you already know what your choice is. Mm-hmm. Right, you're not going to be swayed by some piece of body language in Trump, whether he's leaning forward or leaning back, or smirking or smiling. The assumption behind all that is that we who are engaged in this conversation, we're the savvy ones. We know what we think, and the real question is how is this all going to play with the rubes? And so I think that a lot of the coverage that people see is about that. It's not so much about what actually happened, about investigating the things that are meaningful. Mm. It's just about discussing how it's going to be viewed by people who are presumably less informed, less knowledgeable than the ones who were actually part of that discussion.
We're almost out of time here, Norman. I hate to ask you this question, but I was thinking about other debates where George Herbert Walker Bush looked at his watch. That seemed to be a disqualifier. Al Gore had some heavy breathing that seemed to be a disqualifier. What do you think will disqualify Donald Trump, if anything? Do we have Norm? You seem to be having some technical...
Well, I'm still here, Marty. I could try to answer that.
Okay,
question.
Go ahead, Paul. It's just you and me, apparently. Go ahead. And we're almost out of time.
It's interesting that we focus so much in the press on these kind of decisive moments from these debates.
Right.
And you can see them when they happen. Like I remember very clearly when George Bush looked at his watch, immediately saying, oh, they're gonna pick right up on that. And there really isn't much reason to believe that those things are necessarily meaningful. Oftentimes what they are is it's sort of a vivid illustration of the conclusion that reporters have already made about who these candidates are and what their weaknesses are. And so in that case, the idea was that George H.W. Bush had kind of already checked out, that he knew he was going to lose and that he barely cared anymore.
Just because it's you and me, I hate to do this to you, but we have to end our discussion. Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And that's Paul Waldman, Norman, weekly columnist, senior writer for the American Prospect. Also, we had Norman Ornstein from the American Enterprise Institute with us and Brendan Nyhan from Dartmouth College. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Artie Moskowing. Thanks for joining us.